This is Fresh Air. On this 20th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, President Clinton has lifted restrictions on abortion counseling at federally funded clinics and bans on fetal tissue research and abortions at military hospitals overseas. He's reviewing the ban on importation of the abortion pill RU486. The Supreme Court recently upheld state restrictions limiting access to abortion. My guest is the lawyer who asked the Supreme Court to overturn the restrictive Pennsylvania abortion law and lost. Catherine Colbert had previously won a similar case before the Supreme Court. Colbert is vice president of the Center for Reproductive Law and Policy. Now, with a pro-choice president who has lifted several abortion restrictions, does she think the abortion rights struggle has been won?
No, our fight is just beginning. I think it is very clear to me. In fact, we have, at the Center for Reproductive Law and Policy, have just completed an in-depth look at the federal law in this area, that Reagan and Bush were extraordinarily successful at influencing policy in many, many more ways than we ever imagined. If you take a look at the federal statutes, they are full of policy decisions that favor childbirth over abortion, that discourage women's choice of abortion, that make it more difficult for her to exercise a range of reproductive choices. And therefore, I think while it took 12 years to institute those policies, it's going to be at least 4 to undo them.
When the Supreme Court upheld the Pennsylvania restrictive abortion law, it gave other states an open door to create restrictions on abortion rights there. Do you foresee in the next few years that we'll see a lot of states coming up with their own restrictive abortion laws?
I do. And in fact, this year I think will be one of the worst years we've seen at the state legislative level because the Supreme Court has given states license to restrict in the way that they first restricted in Pennsylvania, waiting periods, bias counseling, restrictions on second trimester hospitalization, restrictions on, the heights of windows and doors, and all kinds of ways that sound reasonable on their face but actually impede women's ability to obtain abortions. And this year, I think, because the Supreme Court has sanctioned some burdens on women, that is, anything that's not what the court called undue, will mean that state legislatures will act in this area, and I think we're going to lose a lot of those fights. My preliminary estimate goes somewhere between 10 and 12 states will pass a new restriction on women in the coming year.
Since the Supreme Court upheld restrictions on access to abortion, how are you going to go about fighting those restrictions?
Well, that's a very difficult job, and that's, in many ways, underscores the importance of the Supreme Court, even in a Clinton era that's supportive. That is, the Supreme Court has said it's all right to restrict. I think we need to go back to states and talk to state legislatures about what these laws really do. Let me give you an example. There's only one state in the country right now that has waiting periods in effect. That's the state of Mississippi. The Mississippi law went into effect in August. Within 3 weeks of the restriction going into effect, the number of abortions performed within Mississippi dropped by over 50%. This is what legislators need to know, that it will have an effect on women seeking abortions. Now, the waiting period didn't change women's minds. That is, that 50% drop is not because they had an extra 24 hours to think about the decision. It was caused directly by the restriction, and those same women were forced to seek abortions out of state or be prevented from obtaining the procedure altogether. And let me explain how that works. A waiting period sounds great, right? Oh, well, women ought to think about these things first. But the reality is women do think about this decision before ever contacting clinics. They often know completely that they want this decision, that they want this procedure. But in Mississippi, there's only 3 abortion providers for the entire state. And many women have to travel somewhere up to 200 miles to get to that provider. The waiting period forces them to go to the provider and come back at least 3 or 4 days later, sometimes as long as a week to 10 days later, because the providers don't, in fact, perform abortions every day of the week. So what sounds very simple, like all women ought to make informed choices, really has turned into a complete obstacle for many women obtaining the procedure.
The obstacle is it takes more time and it costs more money.
Well, it costs a tremendous amount more money because they're talking about two trips of 200 miles to a clinic. You have to take off time from work. You have to get arranged for childcare. Sometimes you have to stay overnight in a hotel if you're lucky enough to have a back-to-back appointment. So all of those things contribute to the increased cost. And it also discourages women from exercising the choice that they think is appropriate for them.
Now, what about the availability of clinics? Some clinics went out of business because of the harassment.
That's right.
So what legal recourse do you have to that?
Well, there's, again, a variety of options. Since the Supreme Court issued the Bray decision last week, the most effective remedy, legal remedy, has been taken away. That is going into federal court and seeking injunctions under the federal civil rights statutes. But I think we can do a number of things. One is we can introduce federal legislation that will create a private right of action and a statutory remedy in federal law.
But what does that mean?
Well, it would mean that you have a federal right by statute to go into court and seek an order against clinic blockades. It would give jurisdiction to federal courts. It would permit federal courts to use the federal marshals. We also, with a new administration, can ask them to begin to enforce existing civil rights laws that were never used in the past because it required the Attorney General to take action. For example, the corollary of 1985-3, which was the subject of the Bray decision, is a federal statute that would permit the Justice Department to come in and prosecute for criminal activity when there's a violation of civil rights. And we would urge the Justice Department to do that. The second, the other area in the violence area that I think is absolutely critical is we have to demand that the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the premier law enforcement agency in this nation, begin to track down the criminals who are harassing women outside of clinics. 12 years of inaction by the Reagan and Bush administration made us think that the federal government couldn't do this. But in fact, the FBI does have jurisdiction. They could tomorrow say we're setting up a special strike force and we're going to track down the people who are bombing clinics and who are committing arson and who are implementing chemical attacks. And it seems to me that's a very important change that could be implemented with just a phone call from the White House.
Now, I'm sure that there will be changes within your opposition. Changes in the anti-abortion movement. Do you know what those changes would be, and do you already have a plan of action to meet the changes in your opposition?
We certainly do have a plan of action, and I think it will reflect that. I think the first and foremost is when our opposition is feeling politically disempowered, there will be an increase in violence and intimidation and harassment. And I think particularly given the Supreme Court's action in the Bray case last week, the likelihood of that increase in violence is very strong. So it seems to me one of our first priorities is to, again, put pressure on the federal government to change the policies in this area and begin to investigate in a much stronger way the level of harassment and intimidation. On the other hand, the same movement is in what I see to be a very stealth move, beginning to infiltrate the school boards to work at the state legislative level around education reform. And it seems to me there's a lot to be done at looking at the kinds of policy changes they're pushing at that level. That means, for example, issues like sex education in the schools, use of condoms in the schools, how we treat sexually transmitted diseases at the educational level and through state policy will all be the focus of the right.
Catherine Colbert, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Catherine Colbert is vice president of the Center for Reproductive Law and Policy in New York. We'll hear from a lawyer with the Catholic Church after the short break. This is Fresh Air. President Clinton's executive orders lifting abortion restrictions were bad news for my guest, Helen Alvarez. She's the director of planning and information for pro-life activities at the National Conference of Catholic Bishops. She's a lawyer who formerly worked in the Office of General Counsel for the United States Catholic Conference. I asked her if she thinks the anti-abortion movement will change its strategy under President Clinton.
Well, I see the church, along with the pro-life movement generally, shifting some of its resources from the legislative arena to the educational arena. Now, we've always had three programs, pastoral, educational, legislative, and we have the pro-life movement over the country, over 3,000 crisis pregnancy centers. You're going to see even more of them opening because there's going to be even greater effort to address the problems that are sending women to the clinics in the first place. Secondarily, this change in direction has really begun, that is, going with more resources even into education, after the Casey decision from the Supreme Court last June. The Casey decision made it clear to Americans generally that real substantive protection for unborn children would really be constitutionally off limits. You could regulate around the edges. You could ensure that women had full informed consent, that parents weren't shut out of their minor girls' decisions. But there is no circumstance in which you can pass a law that is an obstacle to any single child's being aborted. Well, although some legal struggles will go on where they can, for instance, regarding Pennsylvania-style informed consent laws, parental involvement, essentially, we're stuck with Roe and Casey for a while. Clinton is supportive of legal abortion. What he could do to make things worse for us is to follow through on his promise to the abortion advocacy community of supporting the Freedom of Choice Act. So our first object is to ensure that the Freedom of Choice Act never gets to Mr. Clinton's desk. We think we can be successful. We stalled it last summer by raising with various congresspeople during, you know, individual lobbying, very serious moral questions in their minds about whether they truly wanted to be associated with third trimester abortions or whether they wanted to be associated with a law that specifically does not provide conscience protection for hospitals who don't want to do abortions like Catholic hospitals. We think we can raise these moral objections in the minds of congresspeople again, because neither they nor Governor Clinton, when push comes to shove, want to be associated with abortion on demand.
The Supreme Court has decided not to overturn Roe v. Wade, but it has upheld restrictions on a woman's right to abortion. When you look at the Supreme Court and you look at the Congress now, which do you see your future in?
I see our future in the Supreme Court in the long run and Congress in the short run. The Supreme Court has held essentially that no really protective laws may be passed. There is no law which may be passed which may be an obstacle to any woman's achieving an abortion for any reason. So the Supreme Court is in a very extreme position of not just allowing but constitutionally rooting abortions for any time for any reason. In the short run, because President Clinton has agreed to a litmus test, every Supreme Court appointee must toe the line of legal abortion. In the short run, our hope is not in the Supreme Court for according any value or dignity to unborn life in the short run. In the long run, we still have to look to them, however, because Roe and Casey together ground a very extreme abortion policy.
My guest is Helen Alvarez, Director of Planning and Information for Pro-Life Activities at the National Conference of Catholic Bishops. More in 60 seconds. This is Fresh Air. We're back with Helen Alvarez, Director of Planning and Information for Pro-Life Activities at the National Conference of Catholic Bishops. Do you think that the inauguration of President Clinton is energizing the anti-abortion movement?
I'm quite certain of it. Part of my job is to travel the country and speak. And in the last, just since November, I've been to about 16 states. It gives me a good opportunity to take the pulse of the nation. And I've been to 44 states in the last 2 years. What I have seen is that the numbers of people showing up at my talks are doubling. I belong to a group, Feminists for Life. I'm also part of the Susan B. Anthony Fund privately, which is a group raising money for pro-life, pro-women, women candidates. These groups are experiencing an enormous upsurge in memberships, in contributions. People are looking for something to turn their pro-life energies toward. The Catholic Church is sponsoring a letter-writing day on January 24th. We expected maybe a million people to request information from us. About 5 million did. Absolutely ran out our supplies. Even if only a million of those people respond, Congress will be getting an avalanche of letters right at the beginning of their term, indicating to them not only that they should reject the Freedom of Choice Act, but that no matter what position taxpayers take, they really don't want their money or their government associated with providing abortions.
You mentioned that you're part of a movement to get pro-life women candidates elected. Is this a reaction to women who have run for office who have been pro-choice? Are you afraid that the pro-choice groups are getting the women's vote?
That isn't the case, and likely never will be. I'm working on this in my private life, not as part of my work with the church, because the statistics have shown, whether it's Life magazine, Harris polls, Gallup polls, you name it, that women are more pro-life than men. Women, however, are often disenfranchised from seeing their political stand become a reality. There are some well-funded and very well-spoken groups that get a lot of attention from the press who claim to be both feminist and support abortion. There are, however, a myriad of groups, and in fact, with larger memberships under the banner of the National Women's Coalition for Life. They've got 1.8 million members, and they're only 9 months old, who are pro-life. They are pro-women, pro-life. Their stance is that you cannot denigrate the gift that women have of bearing children. You cannot denigrate pregnancy and motherhood without at the same time really implicitly asserting that women have a flaw. And we think that that's the old sexist argument, that our biology is a flaw. We rather would work for policies such as maternal leave, such as adequate child care, such as laws refuting discrimination on the basis of pregnancy, that truly accommodate women, including women with children. We note that it is only women candidates who support abortion who get a lion's share of the press.
Who are the Catholic Church's allies in its fight against abortion? And I'm wondering if you consider yourself allied with some of the more extreme groups who oppose abortion, and I mean militant.
When you say militant, are you referring to people who engage in violence?
Well, I'm referring to two things. One is that for the people who physically bar women from entering abortion clinics, mm-hmm. and also people who use smoke bombs or death threats against people who provide abortions.
No, that would be inconsistent. Our philosophy, our position undergirding everything the church does on behalf of life, whether it's patients with AIDS, the elderly, or the unborn, is the same, that no innocent life should be directly harmed. We don't believe in using violent means, even to achieving very good ends. Thereby, we oppose anything like either verbal violence or physical violence or destruction of property. We do support peaceful protests.
Do you support demonstrations in
peaceful
in which,
demonstrations, that's right.
Peaceful demonstrations which physically bar women from entering clinics.
No, they should not be physically harmed or physically interfered with. Civil disobedience, that is civil trespass, criminal trespass, that is peaceful to everyone involved, that doesn't involve physical confrontation or harm to another.
It seems that every time I turn on the TV, I see one of those Choose Life commercials.
Right.
What do you as a spokesperson for the Catholic Church think of the commercials, and is there any church money behind them, or do you plan on sponsoring a similar TV campaign?
Well, that's strictly secular private money that is behind those commercials. Those cost over $20 million a year. The pro-life movement is supported by people who have less money than those who support abortion. The more money you have demographically, the more likely you are to support legal abortion. Therefore, there isn't a group other than the DeMoss Foundation that I know of that has $20 million a year to put into those commercials. They're beautiful, and they give out a message that virtually no one disagrees with, which is that life is a beautiful choice. The Catholic Church is behind it, and we are also financially in the matter of hundreds of millions of dollars behind efforts to make it possible for women to choose life.
Has the Catholic Church written off President Clinton in terms of his abortion stand, or will you be trying to influence him to come around to see things from your perspective?
We'll be trying to influence him. This is a president who said that he's looking for change. The past 20 years have not shown abortion to solve any social problems. Rather, they've been exacerbated. If he really wants change, he will not support a continuing failed policy of abortion. This is a president who says that he wants a new ethic of mutual responsibility and that he wants abortion to be rare. We are more than happy to work with him on programs like health care and maternal and family leave and child care and poverty programs that will do away with the reasons women are seeking abortions. That would be wonderful.
Helen Alvarez is Director of Planning and Information for Pro-Life Activities at the National Conference of Catholic Bishops. I'm Terry Gross.